Now, I would like to welcome to the show Jason Silverman. He's director of the Cinematheque at CCA. Welcome.
Good morning.
It's good to have you. You sound like you're still in morning mode.
I woke up in the middle of a very intense dream, and so I'm still like a third of the way in that dream.
Right.
Slap me a couple times.
We'll slap you, and caffeine is also always good.
Yeah.
And Chris Wood is joining us. He is a VP at the Santa Fe Institute. He's a neuroscientist. Welcome.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte.
It's great to have you here. And we are here to talk about Science on the Screen. Science on Screen, which is a film series, which is a collaboration with the Santa Fe Institute. Who thought of that? Was that your brainchild?
Jason and I are looking at each other quizzically. Who did think of this, Jason?
It's such a great idea.
I think I did, with a bunch of help from others at CCA. There's a series that goes on in Boston that's a Science on Screen series, and so we modeled it after that.
Now, the film that is next being shown is Memento, which is a film that I just saw last night for the first time, which is absolutely fascinating. You chose that, presumably, I'm guessing, because you're a neuroscientist.
Yes, I did. The way we work with Jason and CCA on this is members of the Santa Fe Institute community, faculty, postdocs, and others propose films that we work out jointly with Jason and with other members of SFI. I proposed Memento. It's one of my favorite films. I like film noir in general. This is a deconstruction of film noir in a very interesting way. But it also really addresses how memory works in the brain, an issue that neuroscience and neuroscientists like myself care deeply about. And it depicts memory, and in particular, a particular form of memory disorder, a particular kind of amnesia, in a very, very compelling way. And I look forward to talking a little bit more about it tonight. And I look forward to, I hope, roping in a bunch of people who've never had the opportunity to see Memento. That's not to say if you've seen it once, you've seen the film, because it, more than almost any other film I know, it repays multiple viewings.
Yes, I can imagine that, because I saw it once last night and was completely blown away and thought, not only do I have to see this again another 3 to 5 times, but I have to re-edit it and put the scenes in a different order. Did you have that experience, Jason, when you watched it?
I try to piece it together, and it's a brilliant work of cinema, too, because the characters and the story evolve in completely unpredictable ways the first time you see it. And then when you watch it again and again, you realize the craft of it. And I'm really interested to hear what Chris has to say about it, because it seems like you can learn a lot about the workings of memory, or think more deeply about the workings of memory and the brain through understanding it.
Well, many neuroscientists who have been quoted about the film say that it is the most realistic depiction of the kind of memory disorder that the central character, Leonard Shelby, suffers from. It's called anterograde amnesia in the neuroscience jargon. What that really means is it's a form of amnesia in which long-term memory is essentially intact, but you can't put any new information into your memory. You have the awareness of a few minutes around the time that you're experiencing, and then it's gone. And I won't give away too much of the film by saying that the central character, Leonard Shelby, suffers a very traumatic event. It's the murder of his wife, and he's hit hard on the head at that same time. And from that, he then begins to suffer this kind of anterograde or forward-looking amnesia. He uses a variety of props to help himself get around that inability. He writes himself notes. He draws pictures. He takes Polaroid photos and writes on them. And in extreme cases, he uses tattoos on his body to help him remember things that he really needs to remember. So the central character is trying to deal with a very traumatic event to himself, the murder of his wife, and play detective at the same time, all with this very debilitating, compelling kind of memory disorder.
And you have scenes in the film, and again, we're not going to give it away, and you have these amazing scenes where he's running, and there's another guy who's running, and he says, "What am I doing? Am I chasing him? Oh, he's chasing me." And it's so great for a detective movie or for an action movie where the hero, who's a strong, good-looking guy who you don't even know if you're rooting for him, doesn't know whether he's chasing or being chased.
Exactly. It's one of the really compelling features of the film.
We're talking about the film Memento. There's a very interesting moment in the film where the protagonist of the film, whose name is Lenny, says about somebody who has a similar condition, who earlier in his life, who he knew had a similar condition to his, that he determined that it was a mental condition and not a physical condition. And I thought, I bet Chris Wood is going to say, I was going to ask you, what's the difference? Is there a difference?
Well, there is a difference, but it's not the difference that most people normally think of when they think mental and physical. And the point of view I'm going to portray in answering your question is I would say consensus view among neuroscientists and cognitive scientists today, and that is simply the mental is the physical, in the sense that everything we know of that is not completely ephemeral, everything has a physical existence. So just like I'm looking at your computer now and you're running some text editor, it's Word or something to keep your notes, just like that computer has a physical underpinning in the electrical bits in the processor and memory registers that implement the word processing program you're using, our brains have physical underpinnings of what we call our minds. They're not the same in the sense that our mind has a has characteristics, has properties that are very difficult to determine if you only have access to the firing of individual neurons, but in exactly the same way that your word processing program is implemented by the electronics underneath, our mind is implemented by the wetware that's between our ears.
The wetware. Our brains are wetware.
Absolutely.
Well, and it...
And let me just add to that, if I may, just not to leave a misleading impression. Neuroscience has come a very long way in the last 150 years in understanding certain properties of that wetware. But the big, big open question is what is or are the fundamental mechanism or mechanisms by which our neurons implement high-level ideas, high-level concepts like memory, like attention, like planning. And one of the things I'm going to talk about tonight is give a quick overview of what we know about that question with respect to memory.
It's such an interesting field, I think, for so many of us, even though most of us aren't going to either become neuroscientists or really have the slightest clue about what you guys really do as neuroscientists. But the thing that is so striking to me is how physical character is. So somebody gets hit on the head and their character changes. Mm-hmm. They change morally, they change ethically, they change in intelligence, and things that you thought were qualities of the person turn out to be qualities of a couple of wires somewhere that got broken.
Well, it may be a couple of wires, or it may be damage to a much larger system. One of the things we're learning about the brain is, and this is directly in line with the scientific approach of the Santa Fe Institute, is that the brain is a complex, adaptive, very dynamic system, and perturbations of that system can create very, very unpredictable kinds of effects.
perturbations meaning you
perturbations
you,
meaning
hit it.
A slap on the head, meaning a particular kind of surgery that happens to remove part of your brain, to remove a tumor or to relieve epilepsy or other disorders. To turn back to the film for just a moment, the kind of memory disorder that that the protagonist Lenny has, this anterograde amnesia, as I mentioned, was first really discovered in the mid-1950s as the unfortunate consequence of a particular kind of surgery for relief of epilepsy in a famous patient whose initials are HM, who died in only a few years ago. He was studied extensively as having this kind of memory disorder depicted depicted by Lenny. The nature of that damage was in a region of the brain called the hippocampus. There are two hippocampi, one on each side in the temporal lobes, and you can your anterograde memory can work just fine if you have damage to one of them, but if you lose both of them, as was the case in HM, it's highly likely that you will have this kind of forward-looking anterograde memory, and it was certainly unfortunate for HM and his family. It was hugely debilitating, and it contributed to a lot of new understanding about how memory works.
Can you imagine being the family of somebody who has that? They remember you, they remember their wedding, they remember the birth of their children, and yet they're basically completely debilitated human beings because they can't remember anything that happened since the accident.
Well, that's exactly right. And as Lenny does in the film, there are crutches, there are clues. With modern technology, one could imagine creating a very useful technologically based system to help one get through the world while having this disorder. That was not possible for HM, and Lenny in the film Memento uses crutches like that, and you can imagine ramifying those into a much richer kind of technologically based crutch.
It seems like there's a lot more tools that neuroscientists can use now, and one of the things that is happening is that they're studying disorders like the one Lenny has to get a sense of the architecture of the brain. Is that?
Oh, absolutely. There are there's a big distinction between structure and function. That is the structure of the brain as an anatomist or an architect might describe it, and then what that structure does, how it operates, how the interactions work together. And there are increasingly clever techniques that neuroscientists and their physicists and chemist colleagues have invented that help us probe the brain in ways that we never could before. There are imaging techniques like magnetic resonance imaging that allow us to get a very good look at brain structure non-invasively from outside the head. There are lots of functional measurements that enable us to look at parts of the brain, both invasively and non-invasively. And very recently, there are many genetically based techniques that enable us in animals to look at how individual neurons operate at great level of detail.
One of the things that I was wondering and that I was going to ask was, how did he remember to take Polaroid pictures?
So that's a very good question, and it's a variant of a question that that a number of critics have posed, and it allows me to make a distinction about a couple of different forms and kinds of memory that we might otherwise treat and lump together as as one thing that turn out to be multiple things. An important distinction is between so-called procedural memory, how to do something, how to ride a bicycle, how to play a piano, versus declarative memory, which is the kind of memory that we can talk about, that is, that we memories that we experience. I just heard your question, that's being stored in my declarative memory. those two kinds of memory are implemented by different brain systems. It's possible to damage one without damaging the other. Lenny has damage to his declarative memory, but he remembers how to do lots of things. He remembers how to drive. He remembers how to take Polaroid pictures. And he's able in the moment to really marshal all of the things he knows, and he then continues to run those forward by virtue of having the Polaroids. Having a Polaroid in front of him or in his pocket enables him to say, oh yeah, that's a Polaroid picture, I took that, where's my camera? So it's this interplay between these different memory systems that is so nicely depicted in the film.
And so it is realistic, the idea that...
It is indeed realistic. The fact that he suffers this trauma and can't remember, can't create any new memories, doesn't eliminate the fact that he knew about Polaroids before his disorder, and that he happens to have a Polaroid camera with him.
Let's talk for a moment, Jason Silverman. You're a filmmaker. Let's talk about the craft of this film. It is an extraordinarily shot and edited and crafted movie, Memento.
You know, what I love about the film is how your understanding of Lenny changes from start to finish. And I'm curious about how that's reflected in the performance. You know, how, because you think you see one person at the beginning and then you start seeing someone different in the middle and at the end. And I just wonder how much of that how much of that is in my own brain and how much of that is the performance and the style with which he shot. And so that's one fact. That's one thing I thought about.
How many times have you seen it?
I've seen it twice.
Okay. How many times, Chris, have you seen it?
Probably in different ways, a dozen.
Okay.
At least. Let me take this opportunity to point out that for any of you who are junkies about this film and haven't seen the special edition DVD, I'd highly recommend it. It contains a number of interesting features, including a 25-minute Sundance piece on the film. There's also a commentary by the director, Christopher Nolan, and that's very illuminating. And there are also some other special features that I won't name specifically in order not to spoil the film for those who haven't seen it.
You don't want to spoil the movie.
No. And I'm the last one who's going to do that.
Excellent.
We're also showing it tonight on a 35mm print, which we had to hunt down. There's only a couple of them left.
Oh, my goodness.
So this is the real thing. You'll get to see it like audiences saw it when they first went to the theater.
That's terrific.
So people have seen this film on video because it's a cult film, and seeing it on screen is a totally different experience.
Exactly.
It's an immersive experience.
So let me take the opportunity to broaden the discussion just a little, if I may. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about Memento because, as I think you can tell, I really love the film, and I look forward to sharing it with people tonight.
I love that there's a film that makes neuroscientists happy. You know, because there was, to interrupt you, sorry, but there was another film about basically the same condition, which was one of the worst movies ever made in the history of the universe, only slightly ahead of Hot Tub Time Machine, and that was 50 First Dates with Adam Sandler and Drew Barrymore. Did you see that? It's
that's
the same condition.
Not a film that I know anything about. I'm
well,
sorry.
The woman has the exact same thing. She had an accident. She can remember everything up to the accident, and then she meets Adam Sandler, and they flirt, and the next time she sees him, the next day, she doesn't remember him because she can't form any new memories. And the film goes on from there. It's the exact same condition. And it so trivializes the illness and makes the whole thing into a kind of happy ending Disney movie and basically doesn't let you know how debilitating this condition is.
Well, the contrast couldn't be more stark with Memento because Memento will leave the audience with a much deeper understanding of what this kind of memory disorder can be like. That was one of the major goals of the of Chris Nolan's effort, I believe. What I was going to do while thanking both Jason and Mary Charlotte for the opportunity to focus on Memento, I thought it would be interesting to just list the upcoming additional versions of Science on the Screen that are scheduled for the next few months. In November, on November 28, Raiders of the Lost Ark with archaeologist and SFI external professor George Gummerman.
Excellent.
Murray Gell-Mann, Nobel Prize winner and distinguished professor at Santa Fe Institute, who brought down the house with Groundhog Day last year, will return on December 13 with The Gods Must Be Crazy.
Oh, I love that movie.
And then in 2013, dates to be determined, computer scientist and physicist Chris Moore, a good friend and colleague, will present and discuss Primer.
Oh, my goodness.
Paula Sabloff, anthropologist and resident faculty at the Institute, will present Never Cry Wolf. And then later in April, Simon DeDeo will make a return visit with Sneakers. So each of these is a very different movie. The relation to science is different in each case, but the links to science and scientists are present in each of them, and it's a great opportunity to talk about science in a very unusual context. And we're delighted to have the collaboration with Jason and CCA.
It's one of my favorite things that I've done as a curator, and it's been 20 years of doing this now, because I'm so curious about what happens up there on the hill, and there's so many brilliant people who are doing research that is relevant to my world, and then we get to pair them with these films that I hadn't thought of in years,
right?
And get new insights into them and basically recontextualize them. It's been such an amazing experience to work with SFI.
I had a question for you, Chris Wood. I mean, we get a lot out of being able to go to a movie like Memento and asking you questions about memory and about the film and neuroscience and things like that. What do you get out of interacting with the public, if anything?
Oh, well, the if anything is a throw off. We get huge amounts from interacting with the public. Contrary to widely held opinion, scientists are people too, and we have all the loves, the hates, the passions, the preoccupations that everyone does, and it's fodder for us as people. It's fodder for us as human beings to interact with intelligent, vital, compelling people of all sorts. It raises new scientific questions in a way that I think we frequently don't admit.
Does it? I mean, when you talk to regular people, do you get new ideas?
New questions arise. Regular people, yourself included, for example, ask questions that we haven't thought about that cause us to rethink and look at questions in new ways. Science, like any other human endeavor, builds up a set of SOPs, standard operating procedures, in scare quotes, that we go through every day. And having those jostled, having those challenged, having to answer what seems to be a straightforward question, a naive question even, can frequently turn us on our heads. And I, for one, love it. And that's what really keeps me engaged by interacting with the general public. It's quite literally, you know, out of the mouths of babes kinds of questions that lead us to shake our heads and say, we never thought about it that way before.
Let's talk about film noir as a genre. This is a, would you call this a film noir?
neo-noir. I mean, it takes some of the conventions of film noir, which is very familiar.
What are those conventions?
Well, there's generally a dark hero who is on some sort of search. It almost always has to do with a mysterious woman, or a mysterious woman is involved. Oftentimes it's shot in ways that are dark and murky. And
especially in the old days of shadowy black and white.
Well, film noir grew out of the budget constraints during World War II. People didn't have a lot of money to shoot, including not being able to shoot a lot on location and not having a lot of money for lights and equipment, so they shot things in a very murky way. So that's the way that started. And they're, you know, they're detective stories, so they've got a question to answer. And so in that sense, Memento fits the bill perfectly. Of course, what Christopher Nolan has done is he's twisted all of those in such a way that this becomes a very, very modern story and asks modern kinds of questions. It's asking questions more about identity than it is about, finding a bad guy or solving some sort of crime.
Well, I agree with that completely, Jason, and I would just add, I appreciate the perspective, and I would just add that all of those features that you described of a classic film noir are in this film, but they're it's like a modern painting. They're completely deconstructed, and they're what's really interesting as a viewer is to try to follow those elements, put them back together again, and see if you can solve the mystery. And the mystery is there. It's still there even after many viewings of the film, which is one of the things I love about it. An additional feature of many films in the noir genre, in addition to the dark hero and the puzzling dark woman character as well, is that there's also a bad guy who's obviously a bad guy, and there appears to be a bad guy in this one too. Exactly who that is, you're going to have to come watch the film too.
It actually shifts as you go along.
Well, some people think that. It's one of the genius features of the film, in my opinion, that on the one hand, it gives you this huge puzzle to work out, and once you think you've worked it out, you got a bunch of other puzzles to face you. And
there's a lot of websites that try to explain the film, and I was reading a bunch of them last night just to see if my reading of the film, which was what just happened, matched any of the other readings of the film, and even those are all different.
Exactly. One of the things I'm going to do for the audience tonight is, after we're finished discussing it, I've prepared a handout that has a half a dozen references to key sites for the film, and also a half a dozen key references, including Nobel Prize winner Eric Kandel's highly regarded book, In Search of Memory. So it's a two-part handout, one about Memento and the other about the neuroscience of memory, that will give these references and links to people who are interested in following it further.
This is why I love this series. Is you get
a
movie and you get additional research and charts and graphs.
I know.
I'm sure when you went to see this movie at the mall when it first came out, you didn't get any of that additional research.
Well, there's another feature of the movie is that while most of it is in color, a lot of scenes interspersed throughout the movie are in black and white, and there are questions about the chronology, like the black and white scenes go in one order and the color scenes seem to go in another order. That's not true.
The whole issue of chronology and its depiction in the film is a very, very important component of what Nolan does to help convey to the viewer what it feels like to have this kind of memory disorder. And I'd love for people to be able to experience that themselves tonight without our giving it away.
All right. This movie, Memento, I think if I had, I don't edit movies, but if I did, I would take, the movie is a deconstruction. I would take that movie apart and look at each scene and make those charts and graphs and try to actually construct the story. Now, Christopher Nolan, who wrote the screenplay, based it on a story by his brother Jonathan Nolan.
Exactly. The story is called Memento Mori.
And is it similarly disjointed?
It is not as disjointed. And one of the interesting features of the discussion is that they actually talked about the short story as it was being written, and the film, the screenplay, almost got started in an overlapping way with the short story. So it was not fully completed before they started talking about the film. The key elements of a person facing this anterograde memory disorder are present in both. But I arguably, from my point of view, the film is much richer and more well worked out. But the story is incredible. It is a short story. It's a quick read, and you won't be giving anything away in the film if you want to read Memento Mori between now and tonight before you see the film.
So if you read the story before you see the movie, will it help you know what happens in the movie?
No. I've basically. And together with your questions and Jason's and my questions and answers, we've basically covered the key elements of the short story. The fact that there is this memory disorder, the central character, the protagonist, suffers from it, and that he is on a quest to identify the killer of his wife. That's the central theme.
Now, did Christopher Nolan consult with neuroscientists to make the movie?
I am unaware that he did. I'm sure he read some, but I know of no specific, in my research on the film, I know of no specific such link. There is a book entitled The Making of Memento that was published by... published in 2002. The author is James Mottram, Mottram. I've not read that book yet, and it may contain that kind of link in there. But there have been neuroscientists who commented on the film after it was released, who have contended. Christoph Koch from Caltech is a leading neuroscientist who characterizes as the by far the best depiction of this kind of memory disorder in film by comparison with the other film you mentioned earlier.
Jason Silverman is the director of the CCA Cinematheque, a wonderful curator, artist, filmmaker, friend. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks for all you do, Mary Charlotte.
And Chris Wood, one of the vice presidents at the Santa Fe Institute. He's a neuroscientist, and he will be doing the question and answers and the introduction for Memento. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're very welcome. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.